Off the ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Jason Sherlock, you're very welcome to the studio. Congrats on the new book.
Cheers, Joe. It's been a while.
It has, yeah. Well, you can't talk to the media now. You know the rules.
That's just a myth. Just don't ask me anymore, Joe.
Okay, well, I'll start asking you from next July through to September and see.
I might have changed my number.
Not many dubs have written books, actually, of your generation. What prompted you? What made you think, I've got a story I want to tell, I'd like to tell?
It was probably a couple of years ago. Just went through, I did a course, an MBA, which was a business course, but one of the modules was organisational behaviour, and one of the assignments was in 3,000 words, write about your life. And that was a really key learning for me to actually have to confront challenges that I highlight in the book and never really thought about. So once I did that process, it really gave me the appetite to say, well, one, I'd like to know more about myself, but two, I thought I could add value, or people could identify with some of the challenges that I had kind of growing up through my sporting career, post my sporting career, and then I suppose some of the philosophies I have now as a coach.
Right.
So that was the inspiration.
You say of your childhood, overall, a happy upbringing, warm, but not carefree, which seemed like a pretty good description. We're talking Finglas, 80s, 90s. You say like Finglas, obviously at that time would have had a reputation and there would have been rough and tough times, but your road, a real nice sense of togetherness and a place you really enjoyed being around.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Carrigallen Park. I was lucky. Finglas, yeah, it has a reputation. I was from the south of Finglas and people call that the posh part of Finglas. So, but yeah, Carrigallen Park was just our little kind of our hub of activity, both boys and girls. We love sport. That was our outlet. I'm sure like most homes around the country, you were turfed out once you finished school, or if you were on your summer holidays and you came back when it was dark. So the passion we had was sport. It could be soccer, rugby, tennis, American football, whatever it was.
Curbs.
So, Pats, as it was called in Finglas.
Curbs and Selbridge, all right?
There's been a lot of debate about the Curbs things, it might be just the Finglas thing, but I always remember it as Pats.
Right, well, we'll compare some rules after the interview. The first time I ever really remember you, and I could be wrong, obviously, but remember you talking about race in any way was with Lee Chin and the Late Late Show, and I think that maybe was pretty much the first time you did it on a platform that big. I guess it seems, reading the book, like, particularly when you came on the scene, the last thing you wanted to do, given your childhood, was hold your hand up and magnify any sense of difference that you might have felt. This was not something for a long time in your life you really wanted to talk about publicly anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the Lee Chin, speaking on the Late Late with Lee Chin, it coincided with the MBA process that I was at a stage where I could reflect back and one, understand it, but two, kind of identify with a lad like Lee and other countless other people that have those challenges and kind of say, well, one, it's wrong, you know, and then the second part was that I could actually help people if they can identify with the challenges that I had. So when I was younger, I used sport as a mode in a way that I'd be accepted. The more I played, the better I played, the more people didn't care in my head how I looked.
Yeah.
It was just about, oh, well, he's the footballer or the basketballer. So that's how I used sport. That was right up to kind of 95 and the success. And that acceptance piece had a big bearing on my sporting ambition. But I suppose with the profile I got in the 90s then, the last thing I wanted again was to be highlighting racism or that, because I did receive a lot of negative attention when my performances were below par. So again, the last thing I wanted to do was kind of put my head above the parapet again. So it wasn't until like I was finished playing at that stage and when I could see back that, yeah, listen, this, it still goes on. It's better, but it's not perfect. But it was something that I felt other people might be going through challenges like this. So it was important to me that I spoke out.
Yeah. the family situation for people who haven't read the book? Your father was from Hong Kong. He wasn't still with your mother. I mean, it was a very full house in Finglas.
Yeah, we lived. Nanny was there and she shared a double bed with my mum. I had Uncle Eddie had his own room, and then I shared a double room with my Uncle Brian. So that was our family.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, like my father, he wasn't married to my mum. He was from Hong Kong. His family, they had a Chinese restaurant just off Grafton Street, and he had a big family there. He moved out of the country kind of when I was young, obviously for work or for various other reasons. So, that part of my life and my childhood, I kind of shunned, and I didn't want to. I was ashamed by it because it brought so much in my head negative attention.
It was. I mean, that side of your life was associated with other lads in your estate. You say what was slagging is now racial abuse. So whichever term you want to use, let's judge them by the time that it was. Those lads were slagging you for this thing. So of course you're going to associate it with some kind of negativity or shame. You know, when you look back, I'd say from this point, it's plain as day. That's how you're going to feel about your ethnicity.
Yeah, and what was interesting when I went through the reflective process, yeah. I spoke to one of my uncles, and he kind of said, "Oh well, we never treated you differently. We always saw you as a dub."
Sure.
And I can understand that message, and it was a great message, but it probably challenged me because if I was to go back, and it's all in hindsight and reflection, if I was told, "Well, you are different, but that's okay because we all are different. That's what makes us special."
Yeah.
Maybe I could have accepted the curiosity or the slagging a bit better. But instead, I just couldn't. There was this contradiction. Why are they treating me differently? Why are they making fun of me when I'm one of them? And then inevitably that would end up in a fist fight or
anger.
Yeah.
There's an incident you tell about putting a rock through neighbour's window who sang Chinese Boy, is it?
Japanese boy.
Yeah. I don't even know the song personally, but obviously you're the one in trouble then. And like, how's a young fella meant to voice this to his uncle who's angry at him for throwing a rock through the neighbour's window? And it's like the unfairness of the situation.
And it's great that that's coming across, because that's how I felt. Yeah. And I'm sure there's people out there, be it through race or just the kind of low esteem or kind of issues that they have, that they feel isolated and they feel that they can't share their story with people. And the one thing that I'd like, the theme coming out of the book, is to, if you have those challenges, share it with someone, because as I said, I built it up to be something that it wasn't, you know. And if I had shared that, maybe I would have been able to accept people when they did slag me or whatever a lot easier. So again, I think there's a relevancy to challenges people have now.
Yeah, like in the book you describe a lot of it as almost ignorance as opposed to racism. You're very kind. You say there was no manual for my family. It wasn't like they knew how to handle this exact situation at this exact time in Dublin where everybody looked the same. The point, and you mentioned it to Ryan Tuberty, which really kind of, it struck me, sometimes you look at kids and you don't realise half of what's going on. Like when you go to the Chinese restaurant and you're ordering fish and chips, they just think, well, this guy's just obviously got a bland palate. And it is amazing what's actually going on behind the scenes with kids. And for you, it was, well, I'm not getting Chinese food.
Yeah, well, that's, and I used to, when kids on the street used to ask me, "Where's your dad from?" I used to say he was a dub. He was Irish, because I just didn't want to be different. Right. I didn't want to be seen as Chinese. And again, yeah, that was how I dealt with it, because my mom, for credit to her, she always wanted us to keep that connection, and I resisted as much as I could.
Yeah.
I was brought to visit the Chinese restaurant, and in my head, the way I built it up was, well, if I eat Chinese food, that's accepting that I'm Chinese. So they used to laugh when I come in and order fish and chips, but that was in my head at the time.
Yeah. So in hindsight now, you say it did damage your self-worth, your self-esteem, your confidence in a very real way.
Oh, it did. There's no question it did. And it kind of, there's an element of paranoia. And then it was great. Obviously, there was the high points coming up to 95. But then when results didn't go that way and there was criticism and negativity, it was always hard to kind of decipher, was it negativity because of how I played, or was it negativity about what I'd become in terms of the profile I'd got? And obviously part of that was the kind of the race piece, that was I seen just because I looked differently, I got more attention. So I was real paranoid about that as well, hence the reason I didn't want to speak out about racism, because I didn't want another reason why people would be critical of me, because I knew, obviously I knew post 95 my performances weren't where I would have liked them to be.
Like the way it ends with your father is terrible, in that it's like this abrupt phone call with terrible news that he's been murdered effectively in South Africa. Given your relationship with him at that point, it's kind of a numb feeling. How am I supposed to feel about this? Would that be fair?
Yeah, I didn't, I suppose, because people have their relationship with their parents, they probably, it is a bit of a shocking kind of end to that relationship. Yeah. But again,
you wouldn't have been talking with him often at that stage.
No, not at all. He'd moved to South Africa. He had a family in South Africa. So again, it was a Friday. I remember I was preparing. We were playing St. Pat's that night with UCD, and I got a call from his uncle Martin, and he just said, "Martin, or Jason, it's Martin. Your dad, he's been murdered. He was robbed on his way home from work or something like that." And he was very upset, and I was like, okay. And he put down the phone, and I was on my own. And again, there wasn't that emotion that I suppose most people would associate with that news. And that's just the way it was for me. So again, it was part of my story, I suppose, as I grew up and as I kind of progressed through my career. So I suppose it's sad in a way, but that was my story. Obviously it was very tough for his family, which I'm sure I'm appreciative of now. There's a lot of upset over the last few weeks, no doubt, having to kind of
listen to
bring
this
it
again.
All up again.
I can appreciate that, because the line which stood out to me the most, I think, in the whole book was where you said, "This is still a part of my life I haven't addressed as I should."
Yeah, and again, I suppose the book, as much as it's about the past, it's also about the present and future. And the last thing I'd like to come across, that everything is perfect. I know I've my challenges, and part of the book is about what the future may hold. And part of that is that family kind of relationship and connection. And it's certainly something that, as I said, they have family in the country, and I do want to make contact, because at the end of the day, I have children. I'm sure my grandparents and my father's parents, they just see me as their grandchild.
Of course.
You know, they accepted me. Maybe I mightn't have seen it like that for a long time, but I think it's important for me to make sure I make that connection and meet them again.
Yeah, but it's to reiterate the point I made a while back, it's very understandable, because you're out in the green with the lads. This is your one, you know, I remember my youth, everyone had something. You know what I mean? It was either an appearance or something about their family or something. You know, there was a thing you could slag people over. This was your thing that the lads would go at you over. And so the more you, I guess, are a part of your father's family's life, the more you kind of exacerbate it, it's going to be associated with them ribbing you. So I can, like, it's really tricky for a kid to navigate that one.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And then that's why I hope that people with similar challenges, no matter what they are, they'll identify with that and hopefully see another way or another solution in terms of how to deal with that.
How often would it have gone way beyond the lads acting immaturely, stupidly? Your mates, a lot of the time probably. How often would it go beyond that? Like strangers having a go? Like the stories of being down in Ballyhea playing hurling, and like N-word is used, and, you know, terrible stuff is said to you on a pitch and you get very upset. Like, how commonplace was that kind of stuff?
It's hard to kind of put a figure on it, because, like, if it happened once a week or 7 days a week, the way I felt was important. So it wouldn't have taken, once one slag, it was back to square one. So, again, it was just the way things were. And I know, like, Ireland has changed, and, like, what's accepted has changed. And, like, we're not just talking in my childhood. Like, I played games for UCD. I played a game for the Dublin senior team in a challenge match, and getting verbally abused by managers and players on the sideline. Obviously, playing for Dublin, I'm sure my family had to listen to a lot. Playing League of Ireland, when it's one man and it's dog at the matches, you heard a lot of slagging. So it's a part of Irish culture. I don't know, it's obviously not a nice part, but the one thing, I don't think we can talk enough about racism, because it's not perfect. So the more understanding, the more awareness that's there, hopefully that will assist people that might have similar challenges.
I spoke to Lee Chin in this studio a couple of months ago, and he was saying his dad, who's lived in Wexford town for 30-40 years, will still occasionally, I mean, again, he didn't put a number on it because I guess that's less important, but we'll still walk down Wexford Town and you might have a group of lads, certain age, 20s, and one of them decides to be a hero and says something stupid. And I couldn't believe that this was, I mean, naively, I just thought, like, you know, Lee Chin's dad's been around the village for so long. Like, what's going on here that these idiots are behaving this way? I couldn't believe it was still something that was that prevalent, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think what's important and what I've learned from doing the book is that it doesn't really matter what other people say. It's how you internalise that message. So again, when I was younger, if someone slagged me, I took it personally. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I understand, well, the problem's with them. It's not with me. Mm. And I think that's the difference where, and I'm sure Lee's father, he can just accept it for ignorance, whereas I just couldn't understand that. I took it personally, whereas now if someone slagged me, well, the problem's with them, you know, it's not with me.
Because if you do take it personally, God, that's powerful and corrosive. Like, that's going to really mess with you.
And that's what happened with me. Yeah. And now in saying that, and I talk about, I think a lot of that was the motivation why I kind of played sport to the level that I did, because I certainly wasn't the most talented person. I wasn't the biggest or anything like that. So there was certainly some fuel that kind of drove that. Yeah. And I think a lot of it was that kind of anger and that desire to be accepted.
Yeah. You used a phrase there where you said, you know, I could hear something and go back to square one. When you say back to square one, do you mean like in terms of how confident or good you're feeling, or what is square one for you?
Square one in terms of the slagging. So yeah. You could go a week without being slagged, but if you got slagged once, you're back to how you feel, like all the emotions. Like, I can still even talking about it and going through the book. Yeah, yeah. It was some great times, but there was a lot of kind of tough times to reflect upon. And I think people who've had any kind of maybe verbal or physical abuse or whatever, it only takes a kind of talking about it and you can go straight back to that time.
Because it builds on all the other stuff which has happened.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And yes. So what does it fit? Is it like horrible tightness? Like Lee Chin used the phrase on being on a pitch when it was said to him once. It was terrible because he said he was the one that suddenly felt a bit embarrassed. This is going back years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
You think, God, it's a double whammy that the idiot who should be embarrassed is not, and actually you suddenly feel incredibly self-conscious and tightness in the chest, all that stuff.
Yeah, and you feel that you deserve it in some way, that is he right to be slagging you, or like do you deserve that? So you feel as if you're at fault for it, which again, as you say, it's a double whammy.
It's horrible. Can you hear how illogical even that sounds?
I know now, and that's why to hear Lee Chin, to hear Aaron Cunningham actually say, I was slagged and it's wrong, and they know it's wrong. Yeah. That was really powerful for me at that time when I heard them saying that.
One sort of last point in all this area of your life before we get onto the sports field was you had the opportunity to meet half brothers and sisters, and I mean, it's really well expressed in the book. Like, they're strangers effectively, and yet they're probably closer to you than 99.9% of the population in another way. And you kind of left that, you left it. And I understood that. I think you were in South Africa. You had the chance to meet them.
Yeah. Well, initially when the funeral took place, I was asked, would I go? And I kind of turned it down because, again, didn't feel there was no urge to do it.
What age were you then, by the way?
I would have been early 20s at that stage when it happened. And then I happened to be in South Africa. I was filming Rapid, which was a TV program way back when, and we were flying out of Johannesburg. It was kind of a couple of years after when my father passed away. And I did contemplate kind of trying to get a taxi out of Johannesburg Airport and go and meet his wife, and that rang home to think about it and talk about it. And again, it would have been a nice thing to do, but I just wasn't sure about it. So who knows? Like, who knows in the future? Yeah, it's something when I had children, it kind of changes the dynamic. And I was very adamant and open with them that they knew they had a grandfather who was from Hong Kong. Mm. And yeah, that's great, Dad. Thanks. And that was the end of it, you know, that way. Yeah. Whereas I built it up so much in my head when I was growing up.
Having your own kids, I don't have any. Do you suddenly realise, well, the unconditional love he would have had for me?
Yeah, definitely. Now, obviously, his circumstances took him out of the country.
Sure.
But certainly his family, who are still in the country, it must have been a challenge for them, because any time I met them, I was met with so much love. I just resisted a lot of it because of how I felt about it. So I've no doubt if and when I do meet them, I'm sure they'll welcome me the way they did when I was a lot younger.
Yeah. I mean, it's the first kind of half of the book. It feels like, in some ways, like the whole book. In some ways, it's so kind of powerful, and it was something you'd never really spoken about. I know Paul Kimmage mentioned to you that he had asked you about your father during your playing career, and you'd always remember that because it seemed like media felt it was too much of an intrusion to ask you about that area. Was that your experience as a player?
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, that was the goal, that I wanted to be seen as Jason Sherlock, the footballer or the sports person. I didn't want to be the fella that looks Chinese. And as I said, it always caught my eye when, because like my uncles used to keep scrapbooks and I'd be looking at stuff, and it was the one, he was the one journalist that kind of mentioned it. And obviously that's a bit, that's the way Paul does things. So yeah, I was intrigued the fact that he had done it. Now, I'm sure I wasn't open or welcome to people questioning where I came from anyway. But
it wasn't a general thing across your career. You didn't often sit down for interviews and it was questions about your family. People kind of almost said, oh, I'll leave him alone here in this.
Yeah, it was never. And again, even if they had asked that way, I probably wouldn't have answered them,
right,
to be honest, because again, I just wasn't at that stage in my development. I probably wasn't comfortable talking about it. I didn't understand it. That's why it's great to do an autobiography at this stage, where if I'd have done it when I was playing or just after I was playing, I think it would have been a totally different perspective. I would have been quite emotional, maybe quite negative in a lot of kind of situations. Whereas now, with the few years, I think there's the reflection piece. I can tilt things in a very positive way in terms of looking at things and understanding why I did it that way and understanding how it'll help me in the future.
Like, from a sporting point of view, you're basically a prodigy. Like, it's disgusting from just so young. You're kind of good at everything. Like, there is a period in your career where you're playing under-15s basketball for the country. You're the captain of the under-17s in 1992. John Horan, incoming president now of the GA, was your science teacher at Vincent's. And, like, we were laughing about it outside, but in second year, you were playing for the sixth year GAA and soccer teams. Which
out of all my achievements, Joe, you think that's the best one?
That was the one that made me stop and go, bloody hell, like, this is ridiculous kind of stuff. So you were clearly pretty awesome, like, in your teenage years at a lot of stuff, despite you saying, as you did earlier, I wasn't the most talented, I wasn't the biggest. Yeah, but you were obviously, you must have had unbelievable hand-to-eye coordination, unbelievable depth perception, all the minuscule skills that you would need to be playing with the 17, 18 year olds when you're 13, 14.
I don't know. I think that the longer I'm retired, the better I've become as a footballer or
right?
a sports person. I don't remember myself being really good. I was competitive. I had a good attitude. I gave it everything. Mm. But particularly in the mid-teens, I wasn't very good. It was kind of, I got a bit better once I got more efficient on my skills.
But No second year in my school was playing
senior guy. Well, that could be to do with the level of talent in our fifth and sixth year classes. But no question, like, John Horan, like a lot of guys and coaches throughout my career, they obviously saw something in me and kind of believed in me, which was a really important part of my sports career. But it's also so important in so many sports careers, because without the impact and the contact of certain coaches along the way that just believe in you, I don't think you get where you end up. So definitely John, he was a guy that, as I said, I wasn't sure why I was playing at that level, but he saw something that potentially other coaches or other teachers wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Make you feel better, Joe? Sorry.
Not really. In my head, I'm like, that's all lies. That's just not true. There's no way that, you know, he'd be playing for the third year team or the under 15s team. Like, when I think of 95, so I was 10 in 95, and I vividly remember with my Kildare friends,
right,
obviously. So we kind of hated you guys mainly, but
still do.
Yeah, obviously, especially now.
Yeah.
I do remember the day when your boot came off and you scored the goal, and like, you didn't have the same haircut as the other GA lads. You'd like, you know, short back and sides. It was just cool. It was like the first time as 10-year-olds we thought, this is kind of as cool as soccer.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so it was like an amazing thing. So even the 10-year-olds right through to everybody watching was kind of, fell in love a bit with you. It was exciting. You were obsessed with scoring goals. All of this stuff was going on. Did you enjoy it, or was it too much, the J-O-mania?
I loved it.
Did you? Okay, good.
Because and that's why it was great to be able to look back at it in a positive frame, because for so many years throughout my playing career, it was like an anchor or weight back there, because people just wanted to talk about 95.
Yeah.
But at this stage, what was great was that I did connect with so many kind of young and old from Dublin and not Dublin. There was obviously a curiosity there. I didn't look like a GA footballer. I didn't play like a GA footballer. And I didn't really want to be a GA footballer. I want to be known as a basketballer, really, right, at that stage. So, yeah, it was great to kind of share the kind of surrealness of that time, because as you say, I was trying to think, in May 94 I won a four countries with the Irish under 17 team, and then like literally the next May I'd won a League of Ireland title with UCD, first division player of the year, had played against Liverpool, and I'd made my debut for Dublin. So a lot happened in a very short period of time.
It was amazing to read it, like you're crisscrossing the country, UCD, to playing league matches with Dublin, and it's like even at minor level you weren't a star, you were kind of a Johnny come lately with the Dublin Miners. Like it's amazing how you went from 94 to where you were in 95. You mentioned Roy Evans and the Liverpool friendly, the UCD friendly, where Evans mentioned you afterwards to the media, but then he sees you in a lobby and says, I mean literally, this is Roy Evans saying to you at 18, 19, you know, you look good there, we'd love to get you over to Anfield to have a look at you.
Yeah.
Here's where I'm reading and I say to myself, stop everything. He needs, like, on a plane the next day. Like, how? I just don't get how you're not over there. And if it doesn't work out, then, grand, I'll come back and play for Dublin. And I should say, by the way, the book doesn't read as if, you know, I could have been a contender and I, you know, I would have made it at Liverpool. There was no guarantees and odds are probably still against you. But Evans stopped you and said, let's get you over. And the offer was there to go over to Anfield. Like...
Yeah, it's one of those, and it's like it wasn't a could have been a contender, but
no.
Certainly when people ask, and it did for literally 5 years, it was the bane of my life, people saying, are you going to Liverpool? When are you going?
Yeah.
So it was nice. Damien Lawler, who helped with the book, like he obviously got the kind of the print back then, and there was a lot of stuff that he was quoted, Roy Evans was quoted of saying, so it seemed as if it was legit. And from my point of view, that was kind of May, and the priority then was to play with Dublin. The summer took off. It took a life of its own.
Yeah.
And I refer to it in the book, if people ask when could have happened. To me, we go back to the Jury's Hotel. I think it was the Dubliner Bar in Jury's at the time. I'm sitting there with Kevin Moran and I'm about to go into the post All-Ireland function. If Kevin, and I'm not saying he could have, but if Kevin had said, right, there's your ticket to Liverpool, you go in the morning, that was the only time that it could have happened, because the reality was my focus changed from that day for a number of years. I was happy to be accepted, and because of that, my sporting kind of ambitions, my sporting ability kind of went on the decline for a few years. So, it was nice to look back, and even like in a squad against England, and you look at the names that were in it, played against Austria, I think Alex Maniger was in goal. Like it was great going back over old programs and to see those names.
I'm sure, Robbie Fowler recognised you a couple of years after the game as well with Stephen
Mannion.
God damn it.
But again, it was such a unique sporting career at that time. It's probably something that wouldn't happen now. Mm. And to be able to share that with a different kind of audience, a different kind of age, to show them what was going on.
No.
Because obviously we mentioned earlier as well, playing hurling down in Ballyhea as well, kind of that's a part of my chemistry as well and added to my love of GAA.
Yeah. The lean years then, I'd always presumed you were sick not to have built on one on Ireland, and it's true, you really were. You say at one point, it's a horrible thing to live your life with a cloud of failure hanging over you. That was becoming the overriding emotion. I was becoming obsessive. That was maybe towards the end of the Tommy Lyons era when you made that point, but that could have been true for a huge chunk of it. They were really, really difficult years for you. Pillar came and really gave it a good go, but... failure is the word. So that's certainly your perception of those years. That's what it felt like anyway. That's very clear.
Yeah, at the time as a player, again, you judge yourself on success and failure. And because after 95, I felt I hadn't done myself justice. I hadn't done Dublin justice. We were a losing team. Mm. I really kind of looked at it then and said, hold on, you're not going to be playing sport all your life. This is what you dreamed of doing. you have to get back there. You have to try and give yourself the best chance to win again.
Mm.
And again, I would have identified with the likes of your Roy Keane's, your Ron O'Gara's, the Tony McCoy's, these guys that had the drive and desire to create the standards. They mightn't have been the most talented players, but they got the most out of themselves. So I kind of took that mantle on in my own head, and I was obsessive about it, there's no question. And when I finished playing, it didn't finish in good circumstances for me. All I could see was failure, because I judged myself on what I won and what I lost. It wasn't until kind of the last few years where I see a lot more positives to go through that time, the resilience that I showed, the character that it took to kind of keep going back year after year and trying to apply yourself. And
there was an interesting evening the week of a game against Armagh. Obviously, Kieran McGeaney had been at Nafina, so you'd seen him up close and personal. You understood what he did day after day after day of training, and you were saying to, it might have been Mick Galvin, I'm not sure, was it Mick Galvin?
That's right, yeah.
And I mean, what a mad thing to say as a player, but the week of the game, basically saying to Galvin, look, I've seen Geezer. I know what these Armagh boys are like. We don't want this more than them.
Yeah, well, Kieran McGeaney, when you talk about influences in your playing career, Mick Galvin, Desi Farrell and Kieran McGeaney would be the three in my head that had a major impact on me. Geezer, we got to see when he joined the Fianna when I was there, and again, he just got the most out of himself physically and mentally, and he set the bar then once I saw how he prepared for things. And again, it probably was relative to where I felt as well, because going into that game, I thought I might play a significant role, and I didn't get starting in the team. And I think it was the morning of the game, I rang Mick, and I'd just been thinking about it, and I said, like, I've seen how Geezer prepares, I see how much it means to him, like I just can't see how we deserve it more than him. And like Mick said, just cop yourself on. And he probably was right, but again, and there's a team in the book, like I there's a lot more than just the winning and losing. Like I had a lot of empathy to people I played against that I beat.
Yeah.
And also guys that I lost.
The Tyrone.
Chris Lawn.
You were delighted to see Chris Lawn win his All-Ireland. Yeah.
And again, because I felt there was a bond, a connection when we played against each other. We bet lumps out of each other for 70 minutes and then we embraced and we hugged after the game. So that to me, it's a massive part of what sport should be about.
To sum up a brief kind of 18 months then, Pat Gilroy comes in. Mickey Whelan's back, you know, the man ahead of his time in 96, 97, you say. You're suddenly doing a lot of things Mickey Whelan was trying to instill in 96, 97. Gilroy's getting the defensive situation sorted out, and that ends up in the Startled Earwigs game against Kerry, and you, with the clock ticking quite loudly now, are just disgusted, and, you know, lads are out in the piss that night, the Dubs lads, and a bit of singing on tables, and you're looking around thinking, what the hell's going on? Ironically, that kind of Roy Keane pursuit of excellence, you know, even that's a Roy Keane story, looking around at lads the night of a defeat, letting their hair down, having a few drinks, you know. Ironically, Pat Gilroy says something to you ahead of the following season, which is ultimately one you're not involved in. Jason, there will never be leaders while you're around. So he seemed to look at you becoming the Roy Keane crank. Gilroy seemed to almost suggest that was inhibiting the younger players, like you were too overbearing. Would that have been a fair criticism in hindsight, or did he have you slightly wrong?
In hindsight, I think it was absolutely fair.
Okay.
And I think even, and that's, I suppose, with that hindsight, I was kind of putting kind of someone at the end of their career, I'm putting my perspective and my standards on young guys that were only kind of finding their own way. And that wasn't fair because they didn't have the baggage, or they didn't have the desperation that I had. They were young kids that had to find their own way. So particularly being on the other side of management now, I can understand Pat. He wanted his younger guys to kind of develop and improve. And he did see me in the way. And as much as for it to be referred to as Roy Keane, to me, was the ultimate compliment, because that's the way I was going. In hindsight, I can absolutely see why he thought that would be detrimental to Dublin progressing, and particularly the younger lads progressing. So again, it's a great, doing it now, it's a great lesson for me, because again, I encounter 30, 35 players. They're all coming from different areas. They're younger, older, they have different goals, different motivation. So it was great experience for me looking back on it to understand. You got to understand what the challenges of the players are.
Desperately hard to take at the time, though. Not least because I'm doing everything right here. If everyone was cranky as me, we'd be doing a whole lot better. A lot of tears, a lot of heartache over the following few years, like real pain.
The proudest part, or one of the proudest parts of my career, would be the years after I was dropped, because to me, I never gave up on Dublin. You know, I went physically until I couldn't do it anymore. Yeah. And I speak about in the book, when Jim came in, one of the first things I had was a conversation with Jim about, would he consider me? And full credit to Jim, now he could have been putting down the phone going, what's he thinking?
Oh, he definitely did.
He probably did, yeah. Because what was I, 36, 37 at this stage? But he opened the door to that possibility. Yeah. He put me in touch with Fergus Connolly, and it was great to get to a stage where I could ring Jim and say, listen, thank you for the opportunity. I'm not going to be physically able to play, and put the phone down, and there was closure. There was release, because I felt now my race was run. It wasn't run in 2009. To me, it was 2013.
One thing which must have been incredibly upsetting was you were doing a bit of work with Caroline Kerr, the sports psychologist. She's working with the Dublin team, and Gilroy had mentioned that lads had been sounded out around that 2010 period if they wanted you back. I don't know who he sounded out. You probably don't know exactly who. Maybe you do, but the word was, no, we don't want him back. That struck me as like, oof, that's betrayal. That's an awful thing to hear.
It was difficult. There's no question it was difficult. But again, I'd have a lot more sympathy and empathy to a manager that is trying to, it was like the wasp that wouldn't die. Obviously, I was this kind of presence that still wanted to go, and obviously he saw it totally different. So again, I've kind of relayed the facts of the situation back then, and yeah, it was tough for me personally, and it led the next couple of years were really tough to swallow.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm delighted to be at this stage of my progression where I can look back at that and kind of understand it a bit more and be a lot more positive about what it was at the time.
The happy finale, I suppose, is that Jim Gavin does get you involved to work with the forwards, and I think he used the phrase about, you know, heart started beating again, and you know, real purpose to your life again, the thing that you love the most, I suppose. And he offered you free rein, and it seems that you've really got that, and he's kind of, you've skipped a few rungs on the ladder almost to get in with these boys, which must be amazing.
Absolutely. We're all kind of grateful for the people that make things possible, and for Jim to go out after they were beaten in Donegal to contact me, like, again, it's to his debt I am that he did kind of reach out to me. So as much as I was delighted, and it was kind of, yeah, just shake his hand, whatever you want you to do, there was a big part of me kind of worried, because I associated myself with that failure.
Yeah.
So it did take a couple of meetings to kind of break down what exactly he wanted. From then, it was, the challenge was to kind of make sure that I had the trust of the players, because again, I wasn't sure what the lie of the land was. So it was really good. And from a sporting point of view, it's just been a great environment to learn. As much as potentially I might be adding value to them, to be able to learn from those guys, it's just been great for the last few years. And again, not that winning kind of changes everything. To be involved with an All-Ireland winning team again, as we were in 2015, it did mean a lot in terms of, it wasn't just me, you know, just to get that release. And again, that's not about the success part. It was nice to be able to bookend the book with, as I have, with a picture in 95 and a picture with the lads in 2015.
Because I don't like 2011. I don't like you in the stand. I'm uncomfortable. I didn't like reading that. I know you're saying, look, I was happy for them, and I'm sure on some level you were, but you know, the notion of your teammates waving up to you in the stand and tapping their heart, and you doing it up to them in the stands, and you go out in a session with them, and next day you admit it gets a bit dark, I suppose, when you get home from the euphoria. Like, that read to me as torture. Like, awful sitting through that.
Yeah, it was a kind of contrast, because there was like, it was, when I was on my own and kind of a couple of days, yeah, it was tough. But like, I was, so my overwhelming feeling when that whistle went was, well, pride and just delight for the lads. And I remember going out to the hotel that night and like embracing Mossy Quinn, embracing Alan, embracing Clucko. And like, they're the things that I remember about that time. You know, it was just so nice because we had taken so much criticism, and obviously I believed in them. I knew that they were capable of winning it, so it was great. Yeah, listen, it wasn't the role that I would have liked to have had, but I was just so happy to see them getting their success.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been at the match. I would have been just get me out of here. I'd be on holidays. A last point then, your work with the Dublin forwards. Can you give us any insights? Like, what have you brought? Yeah, I figured that.
Go on, Joe. Ask the question anyway.
I'd be kind of curious to know, in so much as you can tell me, what you're working on. Like, I was at the Tyrone game, the semi-final. That looked to me like a basketball match, the way Dublin set up. I mean, it's just keeping the width, two on each side. It just looked like basketball was a part of the thinking here, for instance. So that made me wonder, geez, I wonder, has J.O. I know there's another basketball coach who was involved at some point or other.
At one stage, yeah.
Yeah, but I do remember in that game thinking, God, I'd love to chat to J.O. off the record about this and see what's going on here. For instance, you know, that kind of struck me. So I felt maybe your fingerprints were on that one a little bit.
Is there a question there? Sorry, Joe. Yeah. Listen, and you read the book, you can see how precious Dublin football is to me, and to be involved in any capacity is great. I think the one thing as a coach, I will always be grounded in my playing experiences. That's going to bring me wherever I go as a coach. And the one thing, and I do mention it, I was dependent, I was at the mercy of my teammates because I wasn't big and strong enough to win my own ball. So that's my philosophy generally, that it's important that you have your playing to make the team better. Mm-hmm. Basketball, obviously I love basketball. I like the dynamic of it in terms of your five players all on the same wavelength, all looking to do the same thing. It's harder to do in GA because it's 15 a side.
Yeah, okay.
I think you can see there's a lot more kind of intelligence and understanding about how teams play. You only have to look at the defensive strategies the likes of Donegal and Armagh, Tyrone have had over the years. Mm. So it's fun. It's a great challenge kind of looking at that and seeing if you can kind of counteract that to beat it.
So has it reached a point where, say against the blanket defence in particular, because that's more predictable in terms of what you're coming up against, and it seems Dublin have found a way to cope with that and stay calm. So when Kieran Kilkenny is on the left-hand side and in possession, and there's two on the other touchline and there's one ahead of him, does the team have a pretty good idea of where it's going, what's going to happen next, the rotation that's going to happen, or is it play what you see?
I suppose it's a bit of both. You know, ultimately, as a coach, all you can do is prepare your team as best you can. Mm. Ultimately, we're not going to be making the decisions they have in the game. It's up to them to understand that. So all we can do in training is try to prepare them for situations they're going to come against. Like, sport is sport. It's about individuals.
Sure.
It's about creativity. It's about demonstrating your talent. And that's what we want our players to do. So we would at no stage kind of have them like robots that if the ball goes to A, you must do B or C. You know, we empower the players to kind of come up with the answer themselves. I think it's to their credit that people like yourself are observing that and saying, wow, look how they're doing as a team. I think that's the biggest compliment any team can get in any sport, is that they're all playing for each other. And that's just what we aspire to.
Yeah. Last point then. There was a lot of talk about this after the All-Ireland final. The widespread dragging down of Mayo players at the kick out at the end. I mean, I was watching, I thought it was terrible, personally. I understand players do what they have to do to win, and I think Mayo would have done something similar in the same position. How do you reflect on that? Because I know you're a real sportsman and you don't want to see that stuff going on, and you're probably a pragmatist too. So where does that sit with you, something like what we saw in those last few minutes?
Yeah, well, I think your point about if Mayo would do something similar too. So again, it's not a Dublin thing. I think it's the situation and it's the circumstances. And I think
it's not a Dublin thing. And actually, you know, because funny enough, Jim Gavin has come in and said, we're not a cynical team, we only play the right way. I'm not having that. I'm not saying Dublin are necessarily worse than anyone, but I'm not having we only play the right way. I think you're all at it. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, well, I go back to when Tyrone won an All-Ireland in the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
Peter Canavan, one of the most talented players, the last minute rugby tackles Colm Cooper, another one of the most talented players.
Yeah.
So that's, what, 10, 15 years ago. So I would look to our administrators, our rulemakers, to ensure that our games don't finish that way. I know there's been some comment about in certain games how, like in basketball, if you a flagrant foul, you go to the free throw line. So I think there is an element of responsibility on the games makers to ensure, like they have with the black card or the mark, that we're ensuring that we're exasperating the positives about our game. Is important.
So you can think, look, it's human nature. We can tell them go out and play the right way, but the reality is in the closing 2 minutes when there's an All-Ireland final on the line, players are going to do what they're going to do. You kind of feel there's no way of stopping that happening?
I think instincts take over in terms of how teams will win or get over the line. I think the challenge for the actual game, the rules of the games, does the punishment fit the crime? So how can we ensure that games finish the way that you might want it in terms of a spectacle? And I think that's a challenge. It's much broader than Dublin or Mayo.
Oh, it is, because too many big games finish that way when there's a point or two in it. You know, it's the real world. So I think they're going to have to look at it. Your plans are to keep working with Dublin. You start a new business, effectively. You talk about it in the book. So there's that. So I guess consulting with business, the lessons that you can learn from sport. So that's where you see your future, it seems. You kind of found yourself at this period in your life in a nice way.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the process of writing the book has helped with that. So I launched my own website, jo.ie, last week. And again, the simple business concept is authentic mentorship. I'd like to think, based on my experiences, based on the expertise that I might have built up over the years, that I can assess people in their performance, both individually and in a team, be it in a business environment, other sports, or maybe people through education, because they do need kind of mentorship along the way. So it's a really exciting time. It's a daunting time,
I'm sure,
but something I'm really looking forward to.
Okay, well, listen, thanks for coming in and for your time. Best of luck with the book, and you keep that phone on around August, September time next year, and we'll have a chat again.
Looking forward to it, Joe.
Off the Ball on Newstalk,
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.